and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we return this week to the kind of incredible transformation we've seen in the past 6 weeks or so from the discreet and almost universally supported outrage over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis to what has become this divisive wave of social unrest, which clearly has sort of a whiff of the revolutionary spirit about it. And I want to start today with an observation that you made recently in print, which is that we're paying a lot of attention to the people who are rioting, to the people who are pulling down statues, to the people who are bullying others on social media, but we're perhaps not paying enough attention to the other side of the equation, which is what you call their terrified enablers. Explain that.
Well, we are only seeing the face of the revolution, the mob in the French streets in 1793, but we're not seeing Robespierre very much. And the enablers are the people in the larger society and the architects of this revolution. I mean, it's people in foundations, it's people in the university, it's people in the media, and it's even people in the military. If you saw the recent letter that cadets at West Point wrote, it could have come right out of the Stanford BLM movement. And so there's three actors here. There's the people on the front lines, and those are the ones we see burning or looting or toppling statues or marching or chanting or demanding. And then we don't see too often, maybe in the op-ed pages of The Nation or something, we see their enablers. You know, the head of Chick-fil-A will polish the sneakers of a rapper, or some college president will write an embarrassing apology that he didn't really realize how racist he was, or a general will say, you know, my entire life I didn't realize how I contributed to this problem by going to Fort Benning, something like that. And then the final equation is that we don't know what everybody thinks of this. We just look at polls, and the polls show overwhelmingly that people don't want mobs to topple statues. They don't believe that Black Lives Matter should resonate more than All Lives Matter, but they haven't acted out yet. They haven't spoken. They haven't weighed in, so to speak. And I don't know how or when they will, but I think it'll happen. It could happen by just boycotting NFL games or not watching particular TV or going to the movies or not going to Disney World anymore. I don't know how it'll happen, but I think it will before the November election.
I want to talk about one specific part of society that is central to this struggle, one that you've already mentioned in passing, is higher education, because it strikes me you've been writing sort of independent of each other about two trends there recently. One, the way that the universities are kind of exposed now in this time when they're trying in many instances to charge full freight for what is essentially online education, which is really sort of calling the value proposition into question. And then the other front, the way this moment is exposing the maleducation of a lot of the kinds of young people that are out there on the streets for these demonstrations. So talk to us about what the intersection of those two trends means. What kind of shape is higher education in these days?
Well, it wasn't in good shape before because it relied on a lot of things that were very tenuous that they thought were guaranteed. One was $1.6 trillion in aggregate student loan backed by the federal government, which they kept adding to. The other was 360,000 Chinese foreign students that they price gouged with more than premium tuition cost. And the other was that there was a growing sense that people were graduating with degrees that had no marketable value, or at least not marketable value to sustain the amount of debt that was incurred in obtaining them, and they were politicized, combining the worst then of arrogance and ignorance out of their college experience. So then this thing came along, and the public said, wow, these half-educated young people, they just tend to mouth this cultural Marxism. They don't even know what they're talking about. They don't know the difference between Gettysburg and the Battle of Iwo Jima, and they're lecturing the nation on how we're not woke. They knocked down statues of Frederick Douglass or Ulysses S. Grant or Father Sarah or Columbus. They don't know anything. That was one thing that really hurt the reputation of the university. The second was that when the lockdown came in the spring, it happened for most places that were on the semester system. They were able to continue the year. But for those on the quarter system, like the university that I'm hired by, Stanford, this disconnect arose where people were paying the full tuition and room and board, but they were in their parents' basements, so to speak, thousands of miles away, taking classes on Zoom or Skype or Squadcast or whatever methods they used. And they started to say, wait a minute, I could download stuff off the internet from famous Nobel Prize winning lectures for free or for a dollar a lecture, and it would be just as good as this stuff. And I don't get any individual attention. And I paid all this money to go to these Ivy League schools to meet and network and maybe marry somebody in the similarly elite class. And if I can't even do that, what the hell is the purpose of it? Because they don't really offer you a first-class education, at least at the undergraduate level. So I think they're going to have a real problem in the fall charging people these $60,000 and $70,000 tuition rate. And who knows what they'll do with the room and board, which they make money on, but they have enormous infrastructure cost that they have to maintain. They don't seem to be willing to go into their endowment. And they're offending a lot of people, parents, and they're offending their base. The liberal, progressive, elite base is very unhappy of paying this kind of money and then not having a real education. You'd expect them at least to offer radical discounts.
Let's talk about the way that American history is being interpreted as part of this movement. And I'll just present the thought experiment this way. So let's think of the proverbial alien who's just landed on this planet. And let's say that all they know of American history is what they're hearing from these protests, which makes it sound like nothing more really than a parade of horribles. What do you think are the aspects of American history that are most being misrepresented or misinterpreted here?
Well, two. One is that this amazing ability to self-correct. So even though none of the founders that we know of were active supporters of slavery, a couple of them or some own slaves and were going to, you know, manumit them or sell them, they said. But the point is that there was an effort to create this union with the idea that you're going to have to deal with slavery, and that dealing with it meant abolish it as quickly as possible. Now, that took a lot longer than everybody thought, and 600,000 to 700,000 lives. But whatever the issue is, this United States has an ability to adapt. So we have somebody named Inan Omar, who comes from war-torn, you know, North Africa or East Africa, and she arrives here, and suddenly she gets all sorts of tuition credit, scholarship, diversity, affirmative action consideration. She's elected to political office. She goes to Congress. And you would never know that from her. She's never said anything other than this is sort of a, like AOC, a garbage country. The other thing that people don't understand is if you came from a different planet, you'd have a disconnect. You'd say, okay, I'm listening to these horrible white supremacists and their horrible white privilege, but wasn't America criticized by Europe for taking the dregs of the white world? In other words, all of the starving Irish in 1848, 49, all of the starving Jews from Eastern Europe, all of the starving Scandinavians that were farming rocks from Norway and Sweden and Denmark, and all of the Russians. In other words, in these waves of immigration that augmented the original English and then later Scotch and Scotch-Irish populations, the people came with nothing. And in some cases, you know, in the case of the Irish, they were even arguing, they being Europeans, whether they were fully human or not. Some of them came as indentured servants. Some of them came later as the victims of pogrom. Some of them came, not as many as we could have taken and should have taken, but many were fleeing the Holocaust. But you don't get any of that. We just have this binary white and then non-white, and people who are, can be very privileged who are non-white. And then they sort of, I mean, look at AOC. She's a middle-class kid that grew up in the Connecticut suburbs, and her parents were professionals, and she wants us to believe she's a person of color waging a war against these white privileged people. And I see the descendants of the Oklahoma diaspora where I live, and believe me, they're not privileged. The Mexican-American third generation is doing as well or better, no question about it, because of their sheer numbers. And so I think a visitor would say, I don't know what white privilege is. And then finally, maybe a third corollary, everybody wants to come to this country, but it didn't just start now. They're not coming. People are not just coming because it's diverse. They're coming because until recently, there was a rule of law. There was science. When you flushed the toilet, the waste went somewhere. When you turned on the light switch, the lights actually came on. When you went to the ER, you got sophisticated health care. When you went to a university, you got good minds and free debate. That's why people came here. That's why we thrived. And who created that system? Well, it was a Western system that came from Greece and Rome. It was enriched by Jerusalem. It went in through a series of transformations during the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the Reformation. And then it ended up in the British Parliamentary and Scotch Enlightenment, British Enlightenment, and came here. And then it was further transformed. But you don't get that at all. So I would say to all these critics, show me, I'm not going to brag or I'm not going to defend the West or so-called white culture, but just tell me what your alternative paradigm has given the world. And don't just tell me that, you know, Al Sharpton said that people were living in, you know, skyscrapers when white people in rags, all that crap. I just want to know what alternate paradigm, the illogical evolution of which we can see today, China, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Libya, maybe Ghana, Nigeria, maybe a non-colonial place. I don't know, Mongolia. We can go into South America. Bolivia is a shining example. Venezuela, Cuba. Just tell me, Japan. Try to go to Japan if you're black or brown today and say you want to be a citizen of Japan and see what happens. So I don't see the alternate, maybe Mexico. But I don't see, so it's tear down, awful, awful, awful. But then, you know, we're going to tear this statue, but tell me what statue is going to replace it. I want to know. Che Guevara, a murderer. I don't know. A Haitian revolutionary, person who owns slaves. So they've got to give us some examples.
So this whole process starts with a video on social media. And one of the common criticisms of social media is that it can tend to encourage hasty generalizations. So you see a vivid image or video, and if it has sufficient emotional impact, you tend to think it's representative of broader patterns. You tend to extrapolate. So we started out, there was almost universal revulsion at the George Floyd video, but to what extent do you think it's been used to misrepresent the overall state of African Americans in this country, especially as relates to law enforcement?
This generation, just Snapchat or YouTube or whatever the visual image is, 1 second then becomes reality. So they see a picture of a brutal white man with his knee on George Floyd's neck, and they say, everybody does that. And then you say, no, they don't. So let's look at data. And they say, no, I don't want to look at data. I see that image. And you say, well, police killed more white people than they did black people unjustly last year. And if you say, but whites were more, they're more, a larger percentage of the population, then you say, no, in terms of those who were arrested, whites were killed at a greater proportion of those that were arrested than blacks were that were arrested. And then they say, well, look at the general racism. No, in the rare cases of interracial crime, blacks commit violent assaults against whites 5-1. But here's the key point. I ever bring that up. I understand there's endemic racism. I understand there's unfairness. But they always bring it up. They being Black Lives Matter, Antifa, the hard left. And so they don't want to look at facts or data. They just want to look at an image. And then if you say, what are you worried about? What do you care about? Do you care about blacks dying violently in America? There's 7,000 of them that died all over in our major cities. Do you want to talk about that? Do you want to go to Chicago or New York? Or we can look at Los Angeles, or we can go to Philadelphia. And just the last 2 weeks, there's been over 100 black youth killed. Now, why is that? Is it the mayor, the police chief, the governor? Well, they're all left wing. So what are they doing wrong? But see, all of these discussions that are rational, they don't want those rational discussions, because it's not about George Floyd. It's about a sense that the so-called establishment or the people who believe in the founding are weak and they're played out and they're decadent. It's not a racial question. It's just that the traditionalist in America either can't or won't defend his own culture, and you're going to come in and take it from him and make it new. And the irony about it is that they have no paradigm that has ever worked in history to replace it with. In fact, when you see them riot, the first thing you see them do is take selfies of each other. And then they want to, you know, talk, and they have all these sophisticated appurtenances, and none of them could make any of them. No Antifa member knows how to do any of that. So they're all products of a sophisticated technological society that's the fruition of free market capitalism, scientific inquiry, and free speech.
So to the point that you just made about decadence, Victor, there is a sentiment that you hear from certain quarters right now amongst people who don't approve of this radical movement but feel somewhat helpless in the face of it. And they'll argue that maybe we've just got to wait for this moment to burn itself out. And I wonder if you view it as a viable strategy to adopt that kind of passivity, I guess, or does this take affirmative steps either on the policy side or the cultural side to sort of pull us back from the edge?
Well, history offers us conflicting advice. If you're alive in 1793, then you let the Jacobins go full bore and they start killing people that were radical, Danton and others, and then they start to offend people, and then they start to suffer from their own contradictions, and then they're in their extremism, they rename the calendar, the days of the week, they create a new god of pure reason, etc., etc., and they logically burn out. The same thing is true of Mao and the Cultural Revolution. There's only so many intellectuals that you can put with dunce caps in the middle of the street before your society doesn't work anymore. But it also suggests that in the case of the Bolsheviks, which were between 15 and 20% of those who were opposed to the Tsar, they were the most organized. They were the greatest liars. They were the greatest users of violence. And they squashed everybody else. And then, yes, they did suffer the consequences of their own contradictions, but it took 30, 40 million people to die. And so these cultural revolutions are never stable, but if you don't oppose them in the beginning, they'll either do a lot of damage or they'll become entrenched and do even more damage before they suffer. And I'm thinking of the Castro Cultural Revolution or the Chavistas in Venezuela. So it's very important for people to, when you get that memo from your college president, or you get that, you turn on the TV and you see that ambiguity or that appeasement or that enabling, it's very important for people to speak out and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm sorry. And if enough people do it, then it's like putting a stone up the hill. Once it gets to the top and it starts rolling, you'll be surprised about how many people are shocked that they're going to tear down a statue of Jefferson. Who did that? Let's call them to account. But not in the middle of a revolution, because most people want to see who's going to win.
My final question, it's related to that one. There is a confidence in America, born largely of experience, that we are not that vulnerable to these radical kinds of moments, that they've happened here before, and we tend to assimilate the best elements of them and jettison the worst ones. But to what extent is that an essential feature of the United States versus a contingent one? In other words, how pliable do you think we are right now? Do you see a prospect that American society could begin to change in ways that, I guess the way to put it is, in ways that represent discontinuities with our traditions?
Well, it already has. If Barack Obama were to be put on the guillotine and he would have to plead for his life, he would, and somebody read out his campaign platform of 2008, he'd be beheaded. I mean, he was for secure borders, he said. He didn't believe in gay marriage. That's about the worst thing you can do. He didn't even mention transgenderism in his 2008 campaign. LGBTQ community didn't even come in until 2012. So what I'm getting at is that this thing has been really speeding along at an accelerating rate. And we're not such a stable society. We've had the Civil War, and nobody thought that it would be possible in 1850 or 1840 or 1830 or 1859 even. And then it happened, and nobody thought that Mario Salvio and the free speech, you know, these guys had short hair and they wore, you know, creases in their pants and they were very polite. Nobody ever thought that that would lead to, you know, a terrorist incident every 2 days by 1970, or the likes of Abbie Hoffman or Bill Ayers and the rest of these bombers and radicals. So, yeah, I mean, we're not such a stable society, and we've really changed. We have 50 million people that are living in this country right now that were not born in the United States. 20 million of them are not legal, and they need instruction. 27%, as we've said before, in California were not born in the United States. So when you have a large influx of people, and they are told that you don't have to be legal in some cases, or that they are entering a toxic country upon which they have claims upon arrival, moral claims of victimization, that's a very toxic brew. And when you combine that with the world's great fortunes, I'm talking about Michael Bloomberg and Mark Zuckerberg, the Google people, and they're almost all, Warren Buffett, they're almost all primarily left wing, and they exercise enormous power in the popular culture, in Hollywood, in Wall Street, in social media, in Silicon Valley. When you add all that matrix together, it's a very unstable society, very volatile. And you can get some very crazy ideas that are very self-destructive and nihilistic passed off in the popular culture as something acceptable and to be esteemed. No better example than Colin Kaepernick, a mediocre quarterback who was a nihilist and grew up the son of a white mother and a Nigerian father who abandoned him, rather than showing, you know, gratitude that his mother at least kept him. And then he was adopted to two middle-class white people, and he was heretofore known as having one or two good years in the NFL and one bad incident where he called another player an N-word. And suddenly, when things don't go well for him, he dreams up not standing up for the national anthem, and he becomes a spokesman for authentic Black Lives Matter causes. And now corporate America welds itself onto him, and suddenly the guy's worth $20 or $30 million, and he's the spokesman for Nike and Disney. And so, yeah, it's a very volatile popular culture. And 4th of July, he says, you know, this is a white person's day, white supremacist holiday. Does Disney or Nike say, please don't do that? No. But if somebody said, I believe in all lives matter, that would be a criminal offense. You know, we've allowed this thing to get so insidious that absurdity is normality. If somebody paints on a public street, Black Lives Matter, and defaces the public domain, and a terrified city council says, well, we'll retroactively give them a permit, it's okay. And then somebody else, a citizen, says, you know, I'm paying for that. I don't want that slogan on ours. Nobody asks us. And he takes out the, you know, the B, and he alters some of the letters and says, all lives matter. Then we jail that person. Nobody in their right mind ever thought that'd be possible in this country. But it's not only possible, we move beyond that. It's passé now. And so I have nothing but contempt. I'll be very candid for, not that I matter at all, but I have nothing but contempt for the corporate hierarchy. These are people like the Chick-fil-A CEO who said he was going to shine the sneakers of a black rapper to show us how Jesus washed the feet of the disciple. Or all of these four-star generals who are now corporate lobbyists on corporate boards with security clearances, some national security experts that work for foreign governments on security advising. And all of a sudden in their 60s and 70s, they wake up only now. Oh my God, Fort Bragg, I never knew it. Boy, I walked across that green and I saw Lee's statue. I never knew who he was. My gosh, I looked at that Lee portrait in my office, I threw it down, I never knew it. That's where we are today. Not one of them has the guts to stand up and say, you know what, this is a complex country with a complex history that's far better than the alternative and doesn't need to be perfect to be better and good than all the rest, better than the rest and good. And if you want to discuss these things, we have institutional methods to doing it. But we're not in the heat of the French Revolution going to start destroying works of art and traditions and try to alienate as many different people as we can and cause chaos. I haven't heard that. I haven't heard it from the retired military. I haven't heard it from the corporate elite. And I haven't heard it, worst of all, from the university president. I read what they write, and it's just nauseating. It really is, because not once do they say, this university, fill in the blanks, will stand for the Bill of Rights. We're going to defend with our entire institutional resources the First Amendment, the Third, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment. We're going to guarantee right of speech, right of expression, right of due process, right of cross-examination. Just haven't heard it. And that is really frightening how quick the Constitution went out the window.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.